Welcome back to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. Picture for a minute a boss, a handshaker, a barnstormer, a networker.
Come on, people. I'm late for a meeting here. Let's go, 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 go.
I need 10 or 15 skirts from Calvin Klein.
Okay, what kind of skirts do you use?
Please bore someone else.
Because only one thing counts in this life. Get them to sign on the line which is dotted.
Now imagine that quiet guy next to you, just over the divider, is actually the one with all the best ideas in the office. Susan Cain is the author of Quiet, The Power of Introverts. Susan, great to talk to you.
Thank you, Kara. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, you know, you have argued that introverts are undervalued, that they're underestimated very often. In your view, how do introverts approach the process of innovation maybe differently than somebody who's extroverted?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is if you look at the process of innovation, whether you're an introvert or an extrovert, you find that solitude plays a crucial role in the process. It's not the only piece of the puzzle because you also have to kind of get out and exchange your ideas and advance your ideas with other people. But you can't really think in any kind of deeper creative way without having some significant period of solitude. What's interesting is that for introverts, that period of solitude is just a lot easier to come by because introverts are usually craving more solitude than they can get in the modern day world. Whereas extroverts who kind of know they need that solitude often have to willfully fence themselves off. You know, and I see this actually, I belong to a group of authors and most of us are introverts, but there are a few extroverts among us and they often talk about the kind of psychic pain that it can be to, you know, sit still for a long time.
To wall themselves off for a while.
Yeah, yeah. Whereas the introverts among us talk more about the difficulty of going out on book tour, you know.
Right,
so
right.
I think there are challenges no matter what.
So were there innovators that you came across in doing your research that really struck you as like, people may not realize it, but this was a very, what we might think of as a very shy person?
Yeah, I mean, there are lots of them. In some ways, you almost can't find a great innovation process without finding shy people who are a part of it. I'll give you one example, which is the birth of Apple Computer. When we think of that origin story, we tend to focus on Steve Jobs. But in fact, the first personal computer was invented not by Steve Jobs, but by his partner, Steve Wozniak, who was a very shy, introverted guy, like a very warm, lovable, shy guy. And he loved computers. He had this dream. It was a utopian dream of the way the world would be a better place once we could all be connected through computing power. And so he had a job at Hewlett-Packard, and he would get into work and sit at his cubicle in the very early hours of the dawn and then stay there late at night into the midnight hours, and he would work feverishly on this dream of the personal computer. And one late night, working alone by himself in peace, he kind of came up with his eureka moment. It was at that point that he showed what he had developed to Steve Jobs, who said, wow, this should actually be a company. And the two of them together formed Apple. But, you know, often in these origin stories, we tend not to focus as much on the contributions of the people who, by their nature, don't really want us to focus on them.
Well, I was going to say, does that happen a lot where somebody is kind of the silent partner and they do a lot, but because they're not that good at grabbing the limelight, they just sort of, you know, when the history books get written, they don't grab as big a piece as maybe they should.
Yeah, so this happens all the time. And you know, I think for most of these people, they don't actually really care that they're not in the history books because that's not what drives them. They're driven by the need to create their thing. So I doubt that Steve Wozniak minds much that we focus more on Steve Jobs. But the real downside to the history getting written in this kind of lopsided way is that when it comes time to dream up the next innovation, we don't think about creating teams and creating processes that include these kinds of shy, more quiet members, or that that effectively draw on the talents of the people who want to go off by themselves to do their work. And so we tend instead to think, oh, innovation is this really deep group process. You know, it's collaborative, and we take collaboration to mean, okay, let's get everybody in a group together and let's get the ideas bouncing off of each other and everybody, you know, thinking together. But a lot of people get to do their best work when they go off by themselves.
It's interesting that you mentioned collaboration, because I think a lot of people think that is crucial to the process of creating new ideas, creating new technologies. When you look at the research, what does the research show about the benefits of sitting around a table, of pooling ideas versus sort of sitting in your cave and coming up with something yourself?
Yeah, so in some ways, your question reflects a false dichotomy in the way that we as a culture in general talk about creativity and collaboration. We tend to think that collaboration means only sitting with a group of people bouncing off ideas in a meeting, let's say. But in fact, collaboration can look like, you know, what Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs did, where it was you go off by yourself and work, and then you share what you've learned with another person. Or I think of T.S. Eliot, who wrote a famous essay called Tradition and the Individual Talent. And the whole idea of it was that creativity and artistic output is not done alone. It's done by the creator standing on the shoulders of all the figures who have come before that person. And so that's absolutely true. You know, we are all a web and we're all connected. But that doesn't mean that the only way to draw on that beautiful network is to sit physically in the presence of a group of other people to make that collaboration happen. And I think that's where we kind of get confused. And so, of course, sometimes that is the right way to go. But I think we really also need to bear in mind, you know, there's been now over 40 years of research on brainstorming. And all of this research shows that individuals who brainstorm by themselves produce more ideas and better ideas than groups of people brainstorming together. And this is true, by the way, for extroverts as well as introverts. So, you know, if you're thinking about how can you get the best ideas from your team, how can you come up with a true innovation, you're much better off sending each member of the group off by themselves to really do a deep think. And only once they've gone through that process should you be coming together to share what you've learned.
Hmm.
You know, and then even once you're in that together time, you need to be kind of breaking it up regularly and saying, okay, now everybody go off and think again, and then we'll come back after that.
Well, and I know you have thought about and are working on actually designing office space for people who want solitude, for people who want those moments of alone time. In your view, why do offices have to change?
Oh, gosh, yeah. Well, it's funny, you know, I started out my career as a Wall Street lawyer, surprisingly enough. I practiced for about 7 years. And I think part of the reason I practiced as long as I did was because I had this beautiful office to myself looking out over the water and the Statue of Liberty in New York City. And I loved it. And so that was my experience of work life.
the best part of the job was the view, is what you're saying.
Yeah, it was great. Well, but also just like this space to myself. And then
right.
I had all these amazing colleagues who I loved. But, you know, it was more like we were in a dorm. We had all these offices laid out on a hallway and we would come visit each other. But when you wanted to work, you could also go into your private space, you know, and really focus. So that's what I thought the work world was. And then I went off to research my book beginning in 2006. And I started visiting people in their offices and was shocked to discover that most people are working in these office spaces that are these gigantic open spaces,
right.
You know, with no respite at all from listening to other people's conversations or just the feeling of being seen at all moments. And people started to tell me how uncomfortable they were with this setup. And then they said, you know, is there any research on this that I could show my boss just to prove how detrimental this is? They were like, I know this instinctively, but is there research to prove it? So I went out and looked, and I found there was, in fact, a mountain of research talking about what a problem these spaces can be. They make people much less productive. They make people physically ill, literally. And then the real paradox is it's much harder to form friendships in that kind of a setting, because if you think about the currency of a new friendship, it usually depends on the exchanging of confidences. And if you're in a big space where people can overhear you, you can't do that. You feel as if everything can be overheard, so your interactions aren't natural. So people have, you know, they end up developing these more arm's length relationships with each other.
So why do we ignore a mountain of research that says, you know, don't lay out your offices like this? It's not helpful.
Because, and I'm sympathetic to this, it is a heck of a lot less expensive to design an office this way. You know, you can fit a lot of people into one relatively small space if there are no walls. And so that's the real reason. And I think we'd be much better off if we just acknowledge that head on instead of pretending that it's really about enhanced creativity.
So Susan Cain, I'm guessing that, you know, one of the things, so let's say you have this workplace structured in the way that you say, where it is flexible and you can have introverts and extroverts and they might be doing different things at different times, shutting themselves away at some times and collaborating with other people at other times. I'm guessing that one of the things that may be hard for an introvert in that situation is to rise through the ranks, because, you know, you think of a boss, and a boss is the person who greets everybody. There's a lot of handshaking. There's a lot of backslapping. I wonder, you know, how does an introverted person become the leader in that kind of situation?
Right. Well, first of all, I think it's useful to just think about all the introverts who have made it to those kinds of leadership positions. You know, you look at Bill Gates, you look at Warren Buffett. There are introverted leaders all over the place.
How do you know that Warren Buffett is introverted?
Oh, he's talked about it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because he's good at speaking in media. Now, obviously, he is a very calm person, but mm-hmm. he does seem like somebody who isn't terribly shy.
Well, you know, this is true of so many introverts. They kind of learn how to do it. You know, they do media training, or even if it's something less formal than media. Introverts are taught from the time they are in earliest preschool. They are sent the message that you should go out and be more social than might be your normal self. So most introverts have a lot of practice at it. And some are better at it than others. But if you get to hear, as I do, from all the kind of closet introverts out there, you hear from a lot of people who will tell you that they're faking it a lot of the time, or maybe that it's not exactly a fake, but they're pushing themselves out of their comfort zone. You know, and this is all over the place. I recently spoke to General Stanley McChrystal about this, and he describes himself as an introvert, you know, and he'll tell you about the discomfort he feels before he goes into a networking event. I think we tend to think of this question in very extreme dichotomies, you know, and we imagine the introvert is the hermit living alone in the woods. But in fact, we're talking about a third to a half of the population.
Is being introverted necessarily the same thing as being shy?
It's a great question, and the answer is no. So shyness is much more about fear of social judgment, and introversion is more about the preference for just lower key, less stimulating environments, by which I don't mean less intellectually stimulating. I just mean, you know, like less stuff going on. In practice, many introverts are shy, but many really are not. And then you have, on the other hand, you have shy extroverts, like a Barbara Streisand, who is a kind of larger than life personality, but she stopped performing, I think it was for decades, because she had such crippling stage fright.
Right. So for people now who are in businesses, who want to be known as like the innovative person, who want to be a leader in that business, I wonder if technology factors into the equation, because now we have so many ways of communicating with people where you don't have to talk to them face to face. I mean, you don't have to be right there. Do you see that as something that is aiding introverted people?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I hear this from many people who describe themselves as online extroverts, offline introverts. Guy Kawasaki, by the way, who was the famous Apple evangelist.
He's been on the show. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So he will tell you he's an introvert and he loves social media for exactly that reason. You know, he gets to do it from his kitchen table.
That's so interesting because, I mean, when I talked to him, my sense of him was that he was a very sort of funny, carefree person. I would not have guessed that, you know, he was an introvert.
I know. There's so many people like that, you know, who are, I think they're practiced at it. I also think that for many people, as they get older, situations that would have frightened them or inhibited them when they were younger, they feel looser about as they get older. But usually, like, their preference still to recharge in a quiet place or sitting at the kitchen table, that usually stays intact. But the fears of youth often get less, you know, with time.
So a final question. Would it be good if extroverts, the extroverts of the world, could have, you know, a little bit of introvert training and sort of experience what it is like to be introverted?
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, of course, introverts have lots of traits that extroverts can learn from, right? And vice versa. So there's actually interesting research that finds that introverted leaders deliver better outcomes than extroverts do when they're managing proactive employees. And this is because introverted leaders are better at listening. They're better at cultivating other people's ideas and letting those ideas fly, as opposed to putting their own stamp on things. And that's a not insignificant thing. So that's one example of ways that, gosh, you know, extroverts could actually learn to listen a little better or let other people run a little bit better, just the way introverts can learn so much from extroverts. You know, there's no one type who has it all. And in fact, I think one aspect that we don't pay enough attention to is the idea of yin and yang, you know, and that as leaders, like, we shouldn't really expect one leader to be able to do everything. So you look at Mark Zuckerberg at Facebook, who's a real introvert, and he brings in Sheryl Sandberg, right, to be his
right.
COO, and she's a hyper extrovert. And together, they're so much better than the sum of their two parts, or better than either of them could be on their own.
Susan Cain is the author of Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. Susan Cain, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you, Kara. It was a pleasure.